Welcome back to Carson Madison 2020. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. I had a different podcast plan, actually, for today. I had a different podcast going to release, all set up. It was about the coronavirus, but it was not the one that I'm going to give you. The one that I'm going to give you is right off the cuff. It's as fresh as it can be, because I got to tell you, today something happened that made me so absolutely frustrated, bonkers, gone wild, gone mad. I was steaming. I was so angry. And so then I had to do the only thing I knew how to do, which was make a podcast. Hopefully share it with the world, and hopefully you will share it with a friend, so that way that friend will become more educated. You see, I read today, that 37% of doctors believe that hydroxychloroquine is the most effective treatment for the coronavirus. That, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, needs to be discussed once again, because apparently not enough people are listening to Questioning Medicine. Without any further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, welcome back. Question Medicine 2020, Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. And yes, 37% of doctors believe that hydroxychloroquine is the most effective treatment for the coronavirus. Now, that is not saying that they believe it is effective. They just think it's the most effective. But here's the truth. We don't have any evidence saying that it is effective, or at least the evidence we have is not really that good. And I know people are saying, well, you know how hard it is to do a randomized control trial. You know we can't do that. You know we need to do these small little studies just so we can come up with something. But by now, if people would just shut up and do the trial, we'd already have our answer. There are thousands and thousands of people diagnosed every single day with coronavirus. In fact, just take all the patients diagnosed in America on one single day, and we will have our answer if hydroxychloroquine works by the end of the week. But since 37% of doctors think that hydroxychloroquine is effective, let's talk about some research around hydroxychloroquine. Now, I'm not going to touch on the study that I just touched on last week, the French trial of the individual who doesn't believe in randomized controlled trials, but instead believes posting his paper in a non-peer-reviewed journal where the author is also one of the editors and just randomly somehow throws six people out of a study. He believes in that, but he doesn't believe in necessarily randomized controlled trials, and he does believe that hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin really works for your patients with the coronavirus. Now, I'm not going to talk about that one, because if you want to hear about that, you can just go to the last podcast where I spent an entire podcast just breaking down that article, because quite frankly, it actually needed it. So let's talk about some other research that has came out that maybe, just maybe, these 37% of physicians and providers are looking at when they are saying, I think it's the best option for coronavirus. Well, one of the papers they might be talking about is efficacy of hydroxychloroquine in patients with COVID-19 results of a randomized clinical trial. This was a preprint in March 30th, 2020, and this was a non-blinded, single-center, randomized controlled trial that included 62 coronavirus-positive patients. And then as part of the inclusion criteria, patients needed to have CT findings consistent with pneumonia and low oxygen saturations. Part of the exclusion criteria is that the patients could not be severely ill. That is an important part, and I'll touch on it more later. Now, patients were randomized to either 400 milligrams per day of hydroxychloroquine for 5 days or to usual care. The endpoint they're looking for was time to clinical recovery, which was defined as afebrile and no cough for 72 hours. 31 patients were randomized to the treatment arm, and the other 31 patients were randomized to the standard care. The results were as followed. Fever was shortened by 1 day with treatment, and cough was shortened by 1 day with treatment. And there were absolutely no deaths, because it couldn't be critically ill in order to get into the study. The authors say, and I quote, considering there are no better options at present, it is a promising practice to apply hydroxychloroquine to COVID-19 under reasonable management. Now, let's get on to the problems with this paper and why I don't think that the author's conclusions are necessarily spot on. Number one, the endpoint they're looking at was time to clinical recovery, which was defined as afebrile and no cough for 72 hours. And this is not necessarily the endpoint that I care about. Neither the research performers nor the patients were aware of treatment assignments. But there was no placebo. You either got the drug or you didn't get the drug. So how did you blind it? I mean, anyone could figure out, hey, did you get a drug? And if they say, yeah, I got a drug, well, then I know that you're in the treatment arm. And if you say, no, I didn't get a drug for this, well, then I know that you're in the usual care arm. I mean, this, it wasn't blinded. It wasn't blinded at all because you didn't have a placebo. Even your most common, uncommon medical individual or medical provider could easily determine who was in which arm of this study. And since you could determine who was in which arm of the study, and since the primary outcome was time to clinical recovery, don't you just maybe think that when this study is being done in China, in a area of China in which the guidelines recommend that you actually get hydroxychloroquine, that don't you think that maybe there just could be some observation bias that would leak in? That something so subjective as, have you had a cough, but you've been on the treatment medication, could maybe just skew your results just a little bit? And speaking of bias, let's look at these outcomes or these endpoints a little closer. Cough and fever. Cough and fever are not the outcomes that I would pick. They're not the ones that I would choose, but they're the ones that the authors chose. However, resolution of cough, resolution of fever are decent for some patients if you make them part of your inclusion criteria. Part of the inclusion criteria was not needing a fever or needing a cough. You see, how can we say, I'm going to look to see if you have resolution of your fever, if I include you in the study and you don't necessarily need a fever to get into the study? I'm going to look to see if you have resolution of your cough, except I don't necessarily need you to have a cough to get into the study. So what makes me say that you will ever actually develop a fever or develop a cough? It just seems like a really bad endpoint if you're not going to make that part of your inclusion criteria. That's number one. Now let's move on to number two. When you go to the pre-trial registration, it says that there are supposed to be three groups of patients. There was supposed to enroll 300 patients total with 100 patients in each group. The first group was supposed to have 400 milligrams of hydroxychloroquine, second group 200 milligrams, and then a placebo. But where is the 200 milligram group and where is the placebo group? There's absolutely no mention of it. There's no nothing of it. They said, this is how we're going to do it. And then that's not how they did the study. Let's move on. Number three, the study was underpowered. Let's go back to that pre-registry data. Again, they're supposed to have 300 patients, yet you're only reporting on 62 patients. Then clearly your calculations are going to be a little bit off and your p-values and confidence intervals are basically of no value. If you say, I'm going to make a study where I look at 1 million people to find out if drug X works and determine that with 1 million patients, you will be able to find the exact precise difference in drug X. And then only 62 patients into your 1 million person study, you give us your results. I don't know what to do with that. It's like flipping a coin and saying, well, I'm going to flip this coin 100 times. And after three times of flipping it heads in a row, the first three flips, you say, okay, well, that's good enough. Here are the results of my 100 coin flip. They're just, it's no good. You got to throw it out because that's not how the study was powered. Moving on to number four. There were 31 patients in both arms of the trial. If this was true randomization, it almost seems too perfect. It almost seems too perfect to have exactly the exact same number in the exact each arm. No one lost a follow-up. No one dropped out. Everyone is completely perfect. I just don't really buy it. And the paper says, and I quote, randomization was performed through a computer-generated list stratified by site. Except by site? What do you mean by site? It was a single center. In fact, it even says that this was approved for the single center in Wuhan University Renmin Hospital. I don't really know what to make of that. There seems to be something fishy going on here. I can't quite figure it out, but there's definitely some sort of problem. Now, number five. And this is one of my last problems with this study, and that is that the randomization was not equal. Fever at day zero in the treatment arm was 22 people and only 17 people in the control arm. Cough at day zero when they enrolled in the study was 22 people in the treatment arm and 15 people in the control arm. When your outcome is a reduction of fever and cough, you should start with both groups equal. If one group starts out with a head start in the number of patients that have the outcome that you were looking for and your exclusion criteria was severely ill patients, meaning most likely all these patients were going to get better no matter what you did, this is a huge problem and it should have been corrected for, but it was not, or at least it wasn't mentioned that it was corrected for. This is the point where some people will say, well, I know it's not the perfect study, but at least it's something. It's something we can hang our hat on. It's something that will reduce the cough by one day shorter. It will reduce the fever by one day shorter. Well, actually, it's really not something, because that is not the numbers they powered the study for. So you can't really hang the results or hang your hat on the results, because that's not how the study was meant to be ran. If you flip a coin three times and it's head every time for three times, you can't then say, well, there you have it, the coin always flips heads. Or, there you have it, the coin will always flip heads three times in a row every time that it lands on heads the first time. When you go to prescribe a medication, you have to know that the medication is both safe and effective. And currently, we don't have that information. And the fact that providers have lost their minds and say, well, let's just do something in this madness, it's unbelievable. We wouldn't give chemo to a woman because she could get breast cancer, maybe one day, and we shouldn't just give a medication because we think we might have some benefit. We think that it could potentially maybe help maybe sort of one person based on no convincing data. Just like there is no convincing data to give a woman with no breast cancer chemotherapy. But I digress, and let's get back to one more article. One more article that perhaps, just perhaps, maybe the 37% of you that are listening and say, I think hydroxychloroquine might work, could be beneficial on this one study. Well, this one study is titled, No Evidence of Rapid Antiviral Clearance in Clinical Benefits with a Combination of Hydroxychloroquine and Azithromycin in Patients with Severe COVID-19 Infection. This was an observational cohort with data collected prospectively in a single group of 11 consecutive patients who were hospitalized. The patients received hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin for 5 days. The clinical outcomes at 5 days of follow-up was one patient died, two patients were transferred to the intensive care unit, one patient had QT interval prolongation, justifying clinical discontinuation of the medication. And those are just the results, the clinical results of what happened. But Let's take it all with the viral details, the nasal swab, the viral load. That's what all these studies have been done on it. What about the decrease in the viral load? The viral load is what we're really looking at. It's just the repeat of the swab to see if there's, well, let's look at the viral load. Nasopharyngeal swabs were done in 10 out of 11 patients. Since one patient died, you couldn't really swab that individual. Then at 5 to 6 days after treatment, 8 of the 10 patients still had the coronavirus PCR positive, which means 2 out of 10, because you couldn't test the person that was dead, 2 out of 10 were negative. The issues with this study were, basically, it's a really small sample size. It's only 11 patients. Well, 10 if you don't count the person that died. It's an observational study. Even if the patients compared it to a treatment group, well, it's observational, so we can't make the jump to causation. It's only association at this point. Which means, to date, the evidence that I can find is, one, a French study from a guy who doesn't believe in randomized controlled trials, who just randomly threw out 6 patients that published a journal, published a paper, rather, in a journal where the author was also the editor, and he claims that he had 100% viral clearance in patients randomized to hydroxychloroquine plus azithromycin. We also have a Chinese study that was supposed to include 300 people, but instead reported 1 day of decreased fever and cough with just 60 people reported. And we have a French observational study that prospectively looked at 11 patients and found absolutely no benefit. I want to be very clear about something. I'm not saying that hydroxychloroquine does not work for coronavirus, but I'm saying before we go and say words that this does work, before we go out to the masses of people and say, we have a miracle drug, we need a trial that shows that it's effective. If your back's against the wall, if you're the intensive care unit, if you're going to potentially pass in the very near future, and you're just hoping for anything, then I don't think this is a far cry or something that could be used, as long as we understand that it's being used with very little or no evidence. We need a randomized controlled trial, preferably one that is well done. I think we can officially say this is going to be with us for some time now. We can keep producing small trials of only 20, 30, 40 patients. In fact, just use one day of all the American patients that are admitted to a hospital in the whole country, and we'll have our answers by the end of the week. Just like the last podcast, if you learned anything from this, if you learned anything at all, please pass it along to another individual. Please pass it along for someone else to learn, because apparently 37% of people believe that hydroxychloroquine is the best treatment for the coronavirus. And I can tell you, at least in my reading, there is no way that this is a good treatment or a useful treatment or even a beneficial treatment, at least not with the current data that we have. It shouldn't be just willy-nilly prescribed to everyone. So help spread the knowledge, help spread the wealth, because we are all scared. We all want to do what's best for our patients, and we all want answers. So until next time, I'll end this podcast as I've ended every podcast before it. Wait for the music. And until next time, keep the quest and questioning.